for holding. Parties will be on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you can press star one to ask a question. This conference is being recorded. I'd like to introduce your speaker, Ms. Lola Russell.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much. Today, CDC and the Texas Department of State Health Services will be hosting this briefing to discuss the West Nile virus, including our surveillance, our numbers, and to put in context this very important outbreak investigation and our response to it. We'll begin with Dr. Lyle Peterson, who is the director of the Division of Vector-Borne Infectious Diseases here at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, followed by Dr. David Lakey, who is the commissioner for the Texas Department of State Health Services. We also have a couple of state health departments on available that can discuss what is going on in their area if you so desire to do so. So let's begin with our first speaker, Dr. Peterson.
Thank you, and good afternoon. Thank you for joining us for this update on West Nile virus disease. Today, we're releasing new information about the number of people with a reported illness caused by West Nile virus. The updated information, which is based on reports from state health departments, was posted this morning on CDC's West Nile virus website. These data show that the number of West Nile virus disease cases in people has risen dramatically in recent weeks and indicate that we're in the midst of one of the largest West Nile virus outbreaks ever seen in the United States. People around the country are understandably very concerned about the outbreak, especially in hard-hit areas like Texas, where almost half of the cases have been reported. CDC is working closely with state and local public health departments to control the outbreak. We'll describe some of the public health actions that are underway, as well as steps people can take to protect themselves from West Nile virus infection. As of August 21st, a total of 47 states have reported West Nile virus infections in people, birds, or mosquitoes. The only states not reporting activity are Alaska, Hawaii, and Vermont. Of the 47 states that reported any West Nile virus activity, 38 had human cases of disease. A total of 1,118 cases of West Nile virus disease in people, including 41 deaths, have been reported to CDC. Of these, 629, or 56%, were classified as neuroinvasive disease, such as meningitis or encephalitis, and 489, or 44%, were classified as non-neuroinvasive disease. These 1,118 cases and 41 deaths identified thus far in 2012 are the highest numbers of West Nile virus disease cases reported to CDC through the third week in August since West Nile virus was first detected in the United States in 1999. In comparison, 1 month ago, there were only 25 people with West Nile virus disease reported to CDC. Approximately 75% of the cases have been reported from five states: Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana, South Dakota, and Oklahoma, and about half are from Texas. The available information indicates that the numbers of reported cases are trending upward in most areas, including Texas. In addition, 242 potentially viremic blood donors were reported from 26 states. This compares with a total of 25 viremic blood donors reported just 1 month ago. All blood donors in the United States are screened for West Nile virus. By identifying these persons who could potentially spread West Nile virus through blood donations and deferring them from giving blood, we have taken an important step in preventing the spread of the virus and protecting the U.S. blood supply. The peak of West Nile virus epidemics usually occurs in mid-August. However, it takes a couple of weeks before people get sick, go to a doctor, get diagnosed, and then are reported. Thus, cases now being reported reflect infections from a week or more ago. Thus, we expect many more cases to occur, and the risk of West Nile virus infection will probably continue through the end of September. Therefore, it is important for people to continue taking steps to protect themselves from mosquito bites. We encourage the public to use insect repellents when they go outdoors, wear long sleeves and pants during dawn and dusk, install or repair screens on windows and doors, use air conditioning if you have it, empty standing water from items outside your home such as gutters, flower pots, buckets, kiddie pools, and bird baths, and support your local community mosquito control programs. It is not clear why there is more West Nile virus activity in 2012 than in recent years. The weather, numbers of birds that maintain the virus, numbers of mosquitoes that spread the virus, and human behavior are all factors that can influence when and where outbreaks occur. Also, the unusually mild winter, early spring, and hot summer in many parts of the country might have fostered conditions favorable to the spread of West Nile virus to people. It's difficult to predict how many more cases of West Nile virus disease we will see this year. CDC uses surveillance data from previous years to estimate trends in West Nile virus disease, but we don't have models to precisely predict the number of cases that will occur this season. As part of CDC's ongoing work to help prevent and control West Nile virus disease, we do a lot of work in the areas of disease tracking, laboratory studies, and technical assistance in education. In response to the current West Nile virus outbreak, CDC has increased its outreach to provide additional support to state and local health departments. For example, we have provided more than $2.5 million to support increased surveillance and control, including spraying, for Texas, the state hardest hit by this epidemic. At the request of Texas health officials, we also have sent two CDC teams to provide support to Texas state and local health departments. In particular, I want to recognize the outstanding efforts being made by the Texas Department of State Health Services and Dallas County and other counties to control the outbreak. For more information about what is happening in Texas, I would now like to turn the mic over to Dr. Leahy.
Well, good afternoon. This is David Leahy. I'm the Commissioner of Health for the state of Texas. And before I begin, Dr. Peterson and the CDC, you've outlined part of your tremendous support for the state of Texas, but again, I thank you and the CDC for that support. I also want to thank the media. The media has been an essential partner in getting our basic public health messages across the state of Texas and across the nation. And so thank you, and thank you for being part of this teleconference today. And before I get started, I also want to note that it's not just about the numbers. We're talking about a disease that's impacting the lives of hundreds, not thousands, of folks whose lives will be permanently changed because of the West Nile outbreak. And our hearts go out to the families that have been impacted by this outbreak. But what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the statistics, kind of where we are in this outbreak, and then highlight different components of our overall response. And I think Dr. Peterson did a great job of outlining, you know, the huge impact that this disease is having here in the state of Texas. Texas has really been the center of this outbreak. You know, our numbers are a little bit different than the CDC's numbers because of the way data is reported. Our numbers will be updated at the end of today at 4 o'clock, and we do our reporting on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. But, you know, as of right now, we have 586 cases statewide, including 21 deaths. And then if you look at those cases, 323 were the neuroinvasive cases, and 263 were fever. And so, again, 323 that had neuroinvasive disease. And our data has shown that almost over 90%, in some cases 95%+ of those individuals ended up being hospitalized. And again, that data will be updated, and we get more information. We're in constant contact with our counties, and so I noted that we have 21 official deaths, but I know of at least four additional deaths. One death in Dallas that was reported to the media yesterday, two additional deaths in Tarrant County, and one additional death in Collin County. And so, again, a lot of activity, and this, as Dr. Peterson noted, will be our worst season. Again, a little bit of perspective. Prior to this, our worst season was 2003, in which time we had 439 cases of neuroinvasive disease and 40 deaths overall statewide. I'd like to focus in on Dallas, because Dallas, the county of Dallas, has been the hardest hit area for the state of Texas. When we look at their data, the Dallas Health Department has reported 270 cases, of which 142 were the neuroinvasive disease, 128 were fever. You know, with that additional death that was reported yesterday, they now have 11 deaths in the county of Dallas. And again, to give a little bit of perspective on that, if you look at Dallas County data and add up the total deaths from 2003 to 2011, they had 10 deaths. And so we are now, in this year in Dallas County, have more deaths than their entire history in the past. So now I'd like to talk a little bit about our efforts in the state of Texas. And there's several components to our overall response. And in a complicated response like this, one of the lessons we've learned through our other disaster experience is that we have to have a very organized response. And so we set up what we call incident command using our emergency management system several weeks ago so that we can have that type of coordination between the local government, state government, federal government, public health, emergency management, all working together. So a couple of components of that effort. One, we're working really hard to make sure we know where we are in this outbreak, trying to get as much detailed data as possible, working with our local health departments, other entities to make sure we have as much as we can real-time data to make our decisions. And so, again, we're getting that from our local health departments. We're also looking at, are there other ways that besides this case reporting that we can track related to where we are in the outbreak, and are looking at the National Electronic Data Surveillance System to get some of that laboratory diagnostic data to help guide where we are. We've also changed how we're doing some of our tests. In our laboratory, in the past, we did culture for the virus. We've moved to molecular diagnostics, so we've been able to cut down the test, the turnaround time for tests from about 10 days to 2 days, so that we can have better real-time information on the amount of virus that's out there in the mosquitoes in Texas. We've also, as part of our incident command, we've placed staff in Dallas that are working with the city and the county. We've had a lot of engagement with the media, with a variety of entities to try to get those basic public health messages that Dr. Peterson relayed just a little bit ago out. Using printed material, we've put together PSAs, and again, working very closely with the media to get those basic messages out. Now, that's, again, the cornerstone of the response, those things to drain water, wearing DEET, controlling the mosquitoes, dressing appropriately, avoid being out at dusk and dawn. But we've noted that that hasn't been sufficient so far, and so we've complemented that then with insecticide to kill mosquitoes. And we were using ground-based spraying, but as been described in the media over the last several weeks, through a lot of very deliberate conversations, looking at data, looking at national experience, looking at where we are in this outbreak, a decision was made that we needed to step up our approach and provide aerial spraying in Dallas County. Again, I want to thank the CDC that they were side by side with us as we were looking through that data to make sure we were making that the best decision possible. But part of the challenge was if you look at the linear miles of roadage in Dallas County, it would have been impossible for us when we did the math to be able to cover the county with land-based spraying. And again, as we've looked through the data, we felt very comfortable that using aerial spraying was very safe and effective. And so last Thursday, we started our aerial spraying, used two planes, and almost nightly since then, dependent on the weather, we've had used aerial spraying in Dallas County. So far, most of that effort has been in the city of Dallas and the area in the northern Dallas area. We've worked very closely with the mayors throughout the city to make throughout the county to make sure we knew their opinion and their decision on whether or not they wanted aerial spraying. And in the count, in the cities that are in the southern part of the county that told us that they wanted aerial spraying, we're going to partner with them to provide that type of response over the next several days. Again, a lot of activity is taking place. I want to thank the CDC for their support. As it was noted, we've asked for two Epi aides, one here in Austin and one in our Arlington office, to coordinate the response. Again, I really do thank the media for their involvement. They are an essential partner in getting the word out about these basic precautions. We've, again, been reminding folks that spraying is only part of this. If we spray and it rains and we don't take care of the larvae that are out there, the draining of water in individuals' yards, we won't be as successful as we need to be. And so the media has been, again, critical in getting that message out. And so I think that's the end of my comments. But, again, thank you for allowing me to be a part of this conference call today.
Operator, we're ready for the first question from the reporters.
If you'd like to ask a question from the phones, press star 1. Please unmute your phone and record your name. To withdraw your question, press star 2. Once again, it's star 1 to ask a question, and you do need to record your name. Please stand by for the first question. First question is from Mike Stobie of AP.
Hi, thank you for taking the question. I was wondering if you all could say a little more about why this might be such a bad year. I mean, you talked about the winter and the spring. It's the classic triangle, the agent, the host, and the environment. If one of those changes that can affect the amount of illness you have, is it just the environment, or was there any change in the mosquito or in the virus? Just any other thoughts about what's going on this year?
Dr. Peterson?
Yes. Thank you, Mike, for the question, an excellent question. The short answer is we don't really know why it's worse this year than in previous years. As you pointed out, it's a very complicated ecological cycle out in nature with an interaction of mosquitoes, people, and birds. And but one observation that has occurred in over many decades is that in the United States, as well as elsewhere, has been that hot weather seems to promote West Nile virus outbreaks. And many major West Nile virus outbreaks in Europe, in Africa, now in the United States, have occurred during periods of abnormally hot weather. Hot weather, we know from experiments done in the laboratory, can increase the transmissibility of the virus through mosquitoes, and that could be one contributing factor. We have no information yet about whether the virus is mutated. We are currently looking at that issue, but there certainly are plenty of reasons why this outbreak could be occurring now, other than that.
The next question is from Elizabeth Weiss from USA Today.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I have two questions, and the first is just, are you concerned at all that, and you can take this last perhaps, are you concerned at all that a lot of counties and mosquito abatement districts have had to cut back on mosquito abatement because of budget cuts, and is that affecting this? And that's nationwide. But the first question I have is, looking at the numbers you're giving for people who are getting neuroinvasive disease, most of the descriptions I've read of this disease would indicate that only 10 to 20% of people who get West Nile, actually fewer than that, would get neuroinvasive disease, but these numbers look higher. Do you think that's an artifact of reporting, or is this, for some reason, this wave of it having a higher number of neuroinvasive cases?
Yeah, Elizabeth, thank you for the question. Also a very good question. The way our surveillance works is that we certainly record all cases of West Nile virus disease that are reported to us from the states. The neuroinvasive disease cases, testing for these cases is routinely recommended. And as Dr. Lakey pointed out, almost all of the neuroinvasive disease cases end out in the hospital. Thus, reporting is very, very complete. For West Nile virus, West Nile fever, which is the, I hate to use the word milder because it's not so mild in many people, but the non-neuroinvasive disease cases or West Nile fever cases are very underreported. We think that only 2 to 3% actually of all the people who do get ill do get reported. The reasons for this are simple in that most people with West Nile virus disease, we don't recommend routine testing. They're recognized by their physicians. There's no specific treatment for these people, and in the particularly during the course of an outbreak, routine testing is not necessary. Also, many people who do have the milder symptoms don't go to the doctor, and or the doctor may not recognize that they do have West Nile disease. So the most important data that we have are data on neuroinvasive disease cases, since we do believe they're reasonably reported. Does that answer your question?
It does. It does. And then about mosquito abatement and cutbacks?
Well, certainly, CDC does not collect routine data on funding for mosquito control districts and data on the operational capacities of mosquito control districts. But certainly one might suspect that budgetary cutbacks have impacted mosquito control districts, but we don't have specific data on that. Perhaps Dr. Lakey may have some information about that in Texas.
I don't have any specific information. I think, you know, in the past, Dallas County, you know, the last time that Dallas County did aerial spraying was in the 60s. And so obviously I'm concerned about the overall public health funding and part of that being mosquito abatement. But I think also, you know, this is a new virus that has been in the United States now for 10 years. And as Dr. Peterson alluded to, that there have been some of those, you know, I don't think we fully understand why it emerged as dramatically as it did in the state of Texas. And so I think we continue to watch that.
Next question, please.
The next question is from Kevin Finnegan from CBS News.
Thank you, doctors. We're looking into, in previous outbreaks, we followed patients on a long-term basis. Is there any sense of the long-term effects of this outbreak, even for those who have mild symptoms?
Yes. You can kind of categorize it into several different categories. First, let's take the patients with West Nile fever or the non-neuroinvasive disease cases. Several case series have been done. It suggests that for many people, West Nile fever is not such a mild disease. Symptoms can last, you know, from weeks to even months. And we've heard anecdotal reports of people with long-term symptoms even after West Nile fever. So it's not a mild disease, but it generally the symptoms will last from days to weeks to a couple of months. But people do generally pretty well after having West Nile fever. For the neuroinvasive disease cases, there's been about a consistent 10% mortality rate among those people who do get neuroinvasive disease, and a fairly high proportion of those people who do survive do have longstanding symptoms, either cognitive symptoms or otherwise. People who get the paralysis from West Nile West Nile neuroinvasive disease, unfortunately, about two-thirds of those will have persistent weakness or paralysis that can be severe or total. So the outcomes with the neuroinvasive disease and paralysis are not good.
Next question, please.
The next question is from Jeffrey Weiss from the Dallas Morning News.
Do we have any idea what percentage of the population, I guess particularly here in North Texas, has been infected with the virus? And does it confer long-term immunity? Somebody who got bit today doesn't have to worry so much for the next year or two?
We have not modeled yet the number or proportion of people who have gotten, who we estimate will have gotten infected. But as a back of the envelope calculation, about one out of 150 people who do get infected develop neuroinvasive disease. So if you could multiply the number of people with neuroinvasive disease times 150, you'll get an approximate number of those infected. What was the second part of it?
If you get it now, does that confer immunity? Is in many viruses?
Part. If you do get infected now, you will be immune for life.
Well, that's good news.
I don't recommend getting infected now, however.
Next question.
The next question is from Richard Knox from National Public Radio.
Yes, hi. Thanks very much. You partially answered this before, but I wanted to get a little bit more detail on the neuroinvasive disease. Can you describe something about the way that it onsets? What is the course? What happens? What symptoms arise? How is it diagnosed? Just a little bit clearer picture about that particular form of it.
Okay. First, let's start with how it's diagnosed. The way it's diagnosed is either a test of the blood or a test of the cerebrospinal fluid, which is the fluid surrounding the brain. And the test that's generally done is an IgM antibody test. So it measures the antibodies that the body develops against the virus. The test is very sensitive in people with neuroinvasive disease, so it's a great diagnostic test. So that's one thing. As far as the symptoms go, there are really three kinds of neuroinvasive disease that happens. The paralysis, which usually is accompanied by meningitis or encephalitis. So that's weakness of one or more limbs. The paralysis can also affect breathing or swallowing, and so it's one of the more severe and dreaded complications of West Nile virus disease. Meningitis, which is an infection of the tissues surrounding the brain, will cause symptoms like stiff neck, severe headache, eye pain, that kind of symptom, fever. Encephalitis, which is an infection of the brain itself, will cause symptoms such as cognitive problems where people can't think properly. It can cause coma. It can cause all the other symptoms of meningitis as well. But the main difference is it affects the brain itself and thus cognitive function. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. But also, in terms of the time course, do people who get exposed to West Nile get infected? I mean, do some of them proceed rapidly to the neuroinvasive form, or do they go through a fever period? And, I mean, that's relevant, of course, to the promptness of care, right?
The symptoms of West Nile virus infection usually come on somewhere between 3 days and 14 days after the person has been infected. Symptoms can occur very rapidly. I'll give you my own example. I unfortunately was got it infected with the virus back in 2003, and what happened is I was out for a jog, and within 1 mile of my jog, I went from perfectly normal to the point where I couldn't barely walk. So symptoms can happen rather rapidly and come on quickly. And that's probably the norm rather than the exception. How long symptoms last, as I mentioned before, Many of the symptoms, particularly with encephalitis or the paralysis, can never resolve. I mean, some people have persistent symptoms throughout the rest of their lives. With West Nile fever, generally people who do get more ill with West Nile fever will be, you know, laid up in bed for days or a week, followed by a period of just feeling awful. There's a fatigue syndrome associated with West Nile fever where people just are fatigued for weeks or even months after the initial illness. So illness lasts longer than we originally thought for many people with this disease.
Next question, please.
The next question is from Daniel Danoon from WebMD.
Thanks for taking my question. This does follow up on the previous question. So there's that cohort of West Nile patients that's been followed by Christy Murray and colleagues at Baylor. She's followed them for more than a decade and finds a strikingly large percentage of people with what she sees as persistent infection and chronic kidney disease. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, First of all, that you have to talk to Christy Murray about her own results and her studies. We find that her results intriguing and interesting, but we feel that definitely more work has to be done to confirm these findings. And if true, they are of importance.
Next question, please.
The next question is from Donald McNeil from the New York Times.
Hi. Could you talk about the spread of the disease? Where do you see it spreading now, in what directions, and can you address why it might be or not be spreading, since lots more of the country had hot weather this summer than the sections that are seeing the worst parts of the outbreak right now?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. First of all, that what typically happens with West Nile virus disease cases or incidents in the U.S. is that the southern states, if they are affected somewhat earlier than the northern states, probably because, you know, spring appears earlier, et cetera. And so it's not surprising to find places like Texas and Louisiana hard hit earlier than the more northern states. This is a pattern that we've observed over the last 12 years. I think what we're doing is we're following that pattern. Now, the other interesting question is that you brought up is, why is this occurring in Dallas or elsewhere as opposed to, you know, Houston or some other cities? And the answer is we don't really know. We do know that oftentimes West Nile virus is a very focal disease. You can have a lot of cases in one area and no cases 100 miles away. And it has a lot to do with the local ecology of that area, how many birds may be susceptible, the particular population of mosquitoes that were able to breed in a certain area. But it is one of the, they're just difficult to predict and know why outbreaks occur in certain areas and not others.
So you can't predict that it's going to spread in any particular direction now?
Well, when you use the word spread, you're talking about moving from one area to another. And that's not quite what's happening. What is happening is that West Nile virus is endemic throughout the United States. So if you look hard enough, you'll find West Nile virus throughout the continental United States. And it's just a matter of whether enough amplification of the virus occurs in nature to cause an outbreak. So the virus is everywhere. It's just a matter of how much.
Next question, please.
The next question is from Brooks Blanton from Fox News.
Hi. I actually have questions for both Dr. Peterson and Dr. Leahy. Dr. Peterson, first, if you could maybe elaborate a little bit more on the size of this outbreak. You had mentioned one of the largest outbreaks. Is this the largest? And if so, how does it? If it isn't, then how does it rank among past years?
Well, I can only tell, because these outbreaks, the magnitude of the outbreak is very difficult to predict until it's almost over. I can't tell you how many cases are going to occur. But what I can tell you is, as of this date, there has been more cases reported to us than ever before at this particular point in time. So, you know, if things continue on their trajectory, and it looks like, you know, what we've seen in previous years, this will be amongst the biggest or the biggest outbreak that we've experienced in the United States.
Okay. And also for Dr. Leahy, you had mentioned when you were speaking about communities that wanted spraying in Dallas County versus communities that didn't. How are you finding that community? I know some people are concerned about aerial spraying. Are you finding that a lot of communities in your state are receptive to that, or are you finding any resistance, and how do you deal with that?
Sure. I think in Dallas County, they haven't had a lot of experience with aerial spraying, and so we spent quite a bit of time working with the county judge, listening to the medical society, listening to our federal partners, and listening to a large number of folks to kind of weigh, you know, the risk if you do and the risk if you don't, and came to the conclusion that with the amount of outbreak and all the science that said that aerial spraying has been safe and effective. The experience in Sacramento, in Houston, in Boston, and in many other cities across the United States believe that the best way that we can protect the public's health is through the aerial spraying. Now, obviously, there have been concerns. There's been folks that have been concerned related to, you know, are there long-term effects on humans' health? Are there long-term effects on the environment? Communicating messages related to, you know, potential effects on bees, ladybugs, butterflies. We got a lot of questions related to those issues, and we're able to show from the experience in other places, and the way that the spraying takes place, that the effect has been very minimal, if any, on those type of beneficial insects, and no demonstrated effect on human health. So the county judge made the decision that this would be a tool that would be available to the areas inside his county, and then it became the responsibilities of the mayors then to say, yes, we want this, or no, we do not. And you see a little bit of a mix, but overall what we see is, especially as they're getting more and more experience with it, more acceptance that this has been an effective tool and a safe tool. City councils kind of throughout the county are having their votes. You know, there have been councils that have said, we will take land-based spraying instead of aerial spraying. And we've also had a lot of areas that have had unanimous votes that they want the aerial spraying. And so our role as a state then is to support the localities to implement those control measures, and so we're providing the aerial spraying in the areas that have said that they want it, and assisting them in the land-based spraying in the areas that said that they don't, and pushing those basic public health messages throughout the community on what they can do to protect yourself. Again, the media has been an essential partner in that, in conveying those risks and, you know, how these decisions have been made. And, again, has been an essential partner in getting that information throughout the Dallas, and not just Dallas, the North Texas area. I guess that's one of the areas that, you know, one of the messages, you know, as we've had our meetings, is that a lot of focus is in Dallas. But if you look at the data, there's a lot of disease throughout the North Texas area, and making sure that all those areas get the type of support they need to respond to this event. Did I answer your question, sir?
Peggy? Hello?
I'm still here.
I'm hearing the operator. We'll take our last question.
The next question is from Marianne Roser from Austin American Statesman.
Thank you. But on the question of spraying, Dr. Lakey, who pays for that, and how much does it cost? And are other cities in Texas or other counties outside of Dallas County requesting spraying at this point?
Sure. I'll discuss kind of how we're funding this. We have a contract in place that we've put in place because of our experiences with hurricanes that we have ready to activate, and so we activated this contract, and it costs us $1.87 per acre. And so it depends on the amount of area that we cover, and so it's a pretty straightforward calculation. The number of acres times the $1.87 gives us that cost. So the way that we're paying for this is that we've been, again, working very closely with the CDC related to one of our funding streams from the CDC called the Public Health Emergency Preparedness Fund. And so these are dollars that go from the CDC to the state of Texas and then through communities across the state of Texas to mainly focus on preparing for disasters. We have dollars that we call carry forward, dollars that haven't been fully utilized this year. And so we've been working with the CDC to make sure that we can use those funds to help respond to this disaster. We are also complementing those funds with, we have dollars that we have been reimbursed from FEMA related to our previous expenditures for previous disasters. And so we're using, we're working through with the CDC on the exact percentage, but somewhere around a 75-25 mix of the 75% of those PEP funds, Public Health Emergency Preparedness Funds, and then about 25% of those the dollars coming out of those dollars we've been reimbursed recently from previous disasters. Did that make sense?
I think so. So it's a combination of federal and state money that is being used. The locals don't pay for it directly.
So that is correct. Our policy has been that following hurricanes, if we're spraying because of nuisance mosquitoes, that we've asked the localities to pay part of that. In the midst of an outbreak, we are paying for that through the state using, again, that mixture of federal funds that are in our budget that haven't been used and some dollars that we got reimbursed from the federal government related to the previous disasters.
So the rest of my question was, is how much has been spent so far, and are other cities requesting aerial spraying or other kinds of spraying?
So I'd have to pull it up, but we're right at about $3 million. We're at $2.9 million of total cost. We are supporting not only Dallas but other communities. There's been requests related to chemicals for land-based spraying. We've provided trucks. We've had contracts and pulled in trucks to supplement their land-based spraying and other components to supplement that. I think other communities are, I know, are looking at this right now and looking at their overall approach and deciding whether they need to change their policy, but there haven't been any that have officially requested additional aerial spraying as of now.
So only in Dallas County at this point?
As of this point, again, a lot of folks are looking at that very hard, and so there may be additional requests coming.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and that 2.9, I'd need to confirm that, but I know it's been at least 2.5 and has been approaching $3 million.
Okay, we'll say approaching $3 million then.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This concludes our call for today. I want to thank everyone for joining us, including Amy Real with the Indiana Department of Health and Beth Fisher with Kentucky. I want to remind all the reporters who are on the call that the West Nile virus human case count and additional surveillance information is now available on our website. We will be updating those human case counts every Wednesday. And if you would like additional information, please reach out to either the CDC press office or the Texas Department of Health press office or any of the other state health press offices. Our number is 404-639-3286. If That is the CDC main press office number. Again, thank you for joining us. And also, the transcript will be available later on today within a couple of hours. The transcript from this meeting, from this telebriefing, will be available. Thank you so much for your time.
That concludes today's conference. Please disconnect at this time.